From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
This is MC Fontaine welcoming you to another Bletchley Park podcast extra. This week we have the full version of the talk given by Sinclair Mackay at this year's Veterans Day. It's on the subject of his next book, The Y Stations.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me okay? Recognition has been a very long time coming, not merely for all those brilliant veterans who worked within the bounds of Bletchley Park, but also for the thousands of veterans who were posted to the hundreds of Bletchley outstations all over the country and all over the world. These were people who, at all hours of day and night, were tuning in to ever-changing, elusive enemy frequencies, headphones on, inhabiting a curious half-world, and listening directly to the heart of the conflict. These were veterans who were intercepting the German Enigma codes, working flat out with diamond-sharp accuracy and quicksilver speed, and sending the communications on to Bletchley Park. Now, I have to confess, before I started researching the secret life of Bletchley Park back in 2009, I'd never heard of the Y service. And during the course of working on that book, I still only had really, to be honest, the most superficial idea of it, and of how crucial, really, it was to the entire Bletchley operation. All I knew is that it sounded suitably mysterious. What did the Y in Y service stand for? What went on in all those hundreds of outstations? And who were the people who were sent to work at them? What I also didn't quite grasp was the sheer scale of the operation. Where did Bletchley Park get all its raw material from? All those countless Enigma-coded messages sent out in Morse from all corners of the German and Axis military machine in all the corners of the world. Who were the women and the men who sat down day and deepest night and plucked these impossibly scrambled messages from the air? I was aware of Chatham Ford and of the way that the senior codebreaker Gordon Welshman forged very good links with the operatives there so that the transmission of material to Bletchley was incredibly fast, smooth and efficient. But Chatham was just one base. The south coast of England was dotted with listening stations. And not just England. There were stations to be found in Egypt, Murmansk, Ceylon, Singapore. There were converted schoolhouses in Africa and in India, which were home to multitudes of dedicated operatives, all working at high intensity to relay vital signals back to the code-breaking centre. Several years ago, the book that I was writing about Bletchley Park was primarily social history. I wanted to find out and convey what it had been like to live and work on a day-to-day basis in and around such an astonishing institution, and indeed the way that this experience went on to shape so many lives after the war. That book gave me the opportunity, and indeed the great privilege, to meet and talk to distinguished Bletchley veterans. Well, I'm now delighted to say that thanks to the Y Service, I have now had the chance to meet a great many more distinguished veterans, and to hear so many more amazing stories. There are many thematic similarities between the two books. One of the things that struck me when writing about Bletchley Park was the youthful atmosphere of the place. All these bright young undergraduates and sharp wrens, and dutiful debutantes, mingling in an atmosphere that some went on to describe as their university. When I set out to find all about the Y service, that theme of youth came roaring through again. Like everyone in war, these young people had to grow up very fast, but they had some extraordinary and rather exotic adventures too. There was Londoner Bob Hughes, who was barely more than a lad when the war broke out. He was working for the post office, and he had a real aptitude for Morse code. An aptitude wasn't quite enough by itself, though. Y service operatives generally had to be very bright and very fast. And Mr. Hughes told me that they tended to be young because at that age, the brain, he said, was much more adaptable and flexible. It needed to be when faced with the prospect of hearing and transcribing Morse in one ear, listening to other radio traffic with the other. More often than not, deep into the night, all regular sleep patterns completely shot out of the window. Mr. Hughes was first sent to Alexandria. For him, a young lad from Cockney Islington, his first swim in the Mediterranean was utterly dazzling, not to mention almost fatal. He was not a swimmer, and the currents were strong. Later, Bob Hughes was posted to Sardinia, where he had a death-defying encounter with wild dogs. He also had death-defying encounters with the supporters of a local Sardinian football team that Mr. Hughes and his colleagues had had the temerity to beat in a match. Knives were flourished before the final whistle. I met Cherry Ballantyne, now sadly passed away. On a snowy winter's day, she gave me a wonderful lunch at her home in Wiltshire and told me her beguiling story. She started out here at Bletchley Park and then was sent out to Egypt, aged 20. She recalled, with what I thought was a curious twinge of guilt, the colour and the excitement of life in Cairo at that time, the dances, the parties, the sophisticated evenings in the bars of the extraordinarily luxurious hotels. Work at the Bletchley outstation of Heliopolis was hard, certainly, and the atmosphere among the decrypting staff was not always the most harmonious, if the raging internal memos are anything to go by. But there were ample compensations to be found in the vivid sights of the souk or in the boozy parties given by English aristocrats. Cherry Ballantyne always felt acutely aware that others posted elsewhere did not have anywhere close to the amount of sheer splendour, natural and otherwise, that she was able to witness. Now, some who have visited Bletchley Park before will be aware of the brilliant Jean Valentine. Age 19, she was sent out to Ceylon, now Sri Lanka, of course, to crack Japanese codes. As anyone who's ever been on any of Jean's much sought-after tours here can testify, she has a very, very incisive mind that would have been a great asset out there. And her account of life in Colombo at that time captures a world that has, of course, all but vanished. Jean's voyage to that part of the world was not only fraught with hazard, the constant, invisible menace of U-boats, but terrible food, too. Happily, life in Ceylon helped her forget that quite quickly. Off base, she and her friends would dine out, go dancing, go swimming, and when on leave, she and her friends would travel high into the mountains, into tea plantations, and see the plantation owners living lives of hitherto unimagined luxury. All of this appeared to have had the most formative effect on Jean's life. She met her husband out there, and once the war was over, they came back to Britain. Grey, cold, austere Britain. And not long after, set off overseas again, to work in Burma. The Bletchley outstation in Colombo had opened Jean's eyes to a wider and infinitely more colourful world than the one that she had left behind. One of the other truly beguiling stories was given to me by Peter Budd from Bristol, a really, really delightful veteran. At the age of 19, again, having barely been any further overseas than Calais, he passed his aptitude tests and was then posted first to Colombo and thereafter to the tiny Cocos Islands. Desert island specks in the middle of the Indian Ocean, 2,000 miles from the nearest mainland. He was there with just 18 or so other Y Service operatives, there to track Japanese submarines via direction finding and to eavesdrop on Japanese messages and Japanese code. Again, these men had to think fast on their feet, with codes coming in through one earpiece and direction-finding information coming through on the other. There was a constant awareness of the Japanese presence in the waters surrounding these tiny, tiny islands. So Peter Budd and his colleagues would work in civilian clothes. If they were spotted by any enemy plane flying overhead, the lack of military clothing might put the observers off the scent. And added to this, these islands were rubbed off the official maps. For a few years, to all intents and purposes, Peter Budd and his colleagues were living on an island that didn't exist. The work was, of course, extremely complex, but it was carried out in one of the remotest and most beautiful places on Earth. Supplies only came in once every 3 months. The men lived on the most basic tin food, but they didn't care. How could they? Because to compensate for that, and for the grueling shift work, there was the chance to swim with manta rays, to watch sharks lazing in the shallows, to sail out onto the Azure Sea in tiny wooden boats, to enjoy the most unspoilt beaches on the entire planet. Mr. Budd says that he never quite experienced anything like that ever again. Back in England, there were rather less exotic interception stations, such as the establishment at Bow Manor Hall, not too far from here. Even if the local towns to Bow Manor were deemed a little dreary by those who worked there, the hall itself was a rather colourful place, dominated by an eccentrically misplaced figurehead of Admiral Cornwallis sitting in the house's courtyard. Because of its lively mix of civilian and military personnel, Bow Manor had an atmosphere that rather mirrored that of Bletchley Park. Veteran Chris Barnes told me about the music societies that they had there, the sporting clubs, and also of the uncomfortable huts in which they had to work, scanning the airwaves night after night. In wider terms, the Y Service also had some famous recruits too. There was the academic Hugh Trevor Roper, who later went on to have such a public disaster with Hitler diaries. Trevor Roper was actually one of the first people to crack the Abwehr Enigma code by hand. The fact they did so without authorization was a source of terrific anger at Bletchley Park. And indeed, for various reasons, the senior codebreakers here never really quite trusted Trevor Roper again. Trevor Roper was with the Radio Security Service, another branch of Y, and he was monitoring the coded activities of enemy agents. His assiduous analysis of coded messages lifted the lid very effectively on the Abwehr, its worldwide operations, and the seeming chaos at the heart of it. Elsewhere in North Africa, Rommel would have special cause to curse the Y Service personnel based outside Cairo and the mobile listening units who were embedded in the desert. These mobile units, hunched in specially adapted vans and working in extremely inhospitable circumstances of sand, heat, and scorpions, so effectively monitored the German army's communications that Bletchley knew what its supply situation was before Rommel did. This was a brilliant combination of efficiency and ingenuity. A lightning-fast, code-smashing operation that, of course, had to be disguised heavily. For if the Germans had ever gained an inkling of the stupendous achievement, the codes would have been made even more complex. And like Bletchley Park itself, the story of the Y Service is also one of occasional outbreaks of tension and ill will, some jostling, and certainly a lot of furious memos being sent, which can now be found tucked away in boxes in the National Archives. In Egypt, for instance, various code-breaking personnel were at odds with one another, often quite venomously, over the amount that each of them was allowed to know in terms of information. In Bow Manor, meanwhile, working conditions were considered so substandard that the personnel there joined unions and got them to apply pressure. Now, it's slightly odd now to think of unions having any kind of traction during the war, especially when dealing with formidable martinets like Bow Manor's Commander Ellingworth, who really did have a reputation for ferocity. Meanwhile, at RAF Chicksands, things got so fraught for some of the very young women working there that one of them actually punched her superior officer out cold. The authorities were surprisingly understanding about the whole thing, and again, the memos, they make for fascinating reading now. The upshot was that work conditions were made a little better for the women there. Now, for many of the women that I interviewed, joining up with the Wrens specifically for such interception work was quite an aim. They told me that other options were a great deal less attractive. Car mechanics, cooks, etc. Whereas Morse interception and anything involving enemy communications was much more the real deal. Added to this, they said quite shamelessly, the Wrens were understood to be the most glamorous service to be in. This was then mixed in with great pride when they were required to sign the Official Secrets Act. Like those who worked at Bletchley Park, Y Service operatives were not allowed to tell a soul to family or friends, either during the war or for years afterwards. Veteran Betty White told me that she was so sad she was never able to tell her father, because she knew just how thrilled he would have been to hear what she actually did in the war. Now, another of my interviewees, Pat Sinclair, was an East End girl who was too young when the war first broke out to join up immediately. She was raring to go, though, and she knew what she wanted to do, and so she set about learning Morse code. The tests were tough. They only wanted the fastest and the sparkiest. But Pat made it in the end, and she was posted to HMS Flowerdown in Hampshire, an onshore base. And this is where she happened to meet her husband-to-be, as, incidentally, did a great many other young women who were posted there. Perhaps there was a special intensity to life when you were spending your working hours on such crucial and focused duties. The women I interviewed were adamant that in order to hold on to their sanity after all those shifts of hyper-accuracy and deep concentration, their off-duty hours had to be lively and fun. At HMS Flowerdown, and at Scarborough too, where there was a thriving base, the dances particularly were renowned. But there were moments of darkness too. In tiny stations dotted all along the south coast, veterans recalled how, as young wrens, they had listened to the voices of German pilots flying above them, often not bothering with codes. And the German pilots, knowing that women would be listening in, would address remarks to them. Veterans recalled how strangely sick they felt when such planes were brought down. There was a curious intimacy about listening to familiar voices, and also listening to messages sent from familiar operators. They felt that they got to know these people in some funny way. In that golden era of radio technology, the very idea of Morse and interception and official secrets was catnip to technically minded men, and also particularly to boys. Two of my interviewees, Geoffrey Pidgeon and Ray Faultley, got their induction into the wire services when they were boys, absolutely fascinated by the technology of radio. Ray Faultley was adept at building his own wireless set, and he had been since very young. Aged 16, he was working for the radio firm Marconi and living at home with his parents in South London. Then one day, in 1940, he got a visit from the man from the ministry. He was recruited into the VIs, the Voluntary Interceptors. He would be required to set up a secret radio in his parents' front parlour, concealed within a bureau. Now, his parents knew about the radio, but even his parents weren't allowed to know anything about the nature of the work that he was being asked to do. When he got home from work each evening, Ray would be required to do 2 hours interception work, tuning in specifically to German Abwehr frequencies. Having noted down all the intercepted messages, he then had to post them in special envelopes provided to a P.O. box in Barnet, North London. It was here, at Arkley View, that an entire establishment sifted through the interceptions gathered by 1,500 or so such volunteers on a daily basis, and the efforts of these volunteers were greatly appreciated. Although the top secrecy of their work could cause awkward moments, Ray Faultley's young girlfriend, for instance, like his parents, never knew anything about the nature of his evening duties. One night, she walked into the front parlour unannounced as he was crouched over his radio, headphones clamped on. Now, she immediately ran out of the house into the street because she thought that he was a spy. She had run off to fetch a policeman, and Ray Faultley had to chase her up the street in order to stop her just in time. Meanwhile, in Surrey, the 14-year-old Geoffrey Pidgeon was intrigued by the activities of two men who had been billeted with his family. These men seemed to come and go the whole time and never gave any hint of the work that they were doing. But one day, there was a telephone call for one of them. Geoffrey ran upstairs to get him, walked into his room, and saw the man there talking into some very outlandish and, from Geoffrey's point of view, rather futuristic-looking radio equipment. The two billetees were with Wadden Hall, and part of their work was to supply top-secret radios to agents in the field. And so it was that first, Geoffrey's father, and then Geoffrey himself, were recruited, pulled into the orbit of Wadden Hall. The entire family moved to Stony Stratford, and Geoffrey was allowed to leave school early in order to work there, in the fascinating workshops, and later testing out new equipment in the air and at sea. In many ways, a technically-minded boy's dream come true. It was like getting to work in Q's laboratory. In the more rarefied echelons of the Y service, we see now in declassified memos a fascinating reflection of the geopolitics of the time. In 1942, just weeks after America entered the war, there are US interceptors establishing themselves on British soil and negotiating very delicately how the Americans and the British are to share their information. In 1943, again, from the memos, we see a senior representative of the British Y Service in Moscow trying to deal with the endlessly paranoid Soviets, while at the same time keeping from them the great secret of how Bletchley Park was smashing the codes. Now, of course, the Germans were intercepting everywhere as well. and sometimes what happened was incredibly complicated games of smoke and mirrors. For instance, the Y-Server's base in Malta tricked Italian interceptors into believing the British Navy was doing one thing when in fact it was doing another. By sending out false messages, the listeners could then trick Germans into issuing fresh orders to one another that would then be instantly intercepted by the wire services, decoded, and passed on to the relevant military authorities to take action on. In other words, all the downsides of the job, the headphones, the pads, the pencils, the aching fingers, the damage to hearing caused by thunderstorms and other shock interference, were counterbalanced with many moments of sheer delight and devilment and ingenuity. Even in the most unpromising and bleakest of Y stations, they still managed to have some fun. Even the secret listeners on the Arctic convoys, who would stop off in Murmansk to enjoy games of sub-zero football in shorts, as the Soviet locals looked on in dumbfounded astonishment. Like the veterans of Bletchley Park, fitting public acknowledgement of the vital work of the Y service has been a very long time coming, and for many, a great deal too late. In 2009, veterans received a commemorative medal, together with a letter from the then Prime Minister Gordon Brown. That Y Service veteran Pat Sinclair told me, a friend of mine got hers and she was furious. This apparently was on the grounds of political disapproval. The friend just didn't like Gordon Brown. Mrs. Sinclair, on the other hand, was absolutely thrilled to have received her own citation from a Labour Prime Minister, so it cuts both ways. Possibly also because of numbers, and because of the extraordinary adventures that so many of them had, the various branches of the Y Services seem to have been quite good at organising reunions over the years, giving a sense of community and remembrance that perhaps was denied to many who had worked at the slightly more secretive Bletchley Park. And when reunions were not always possible, there were also lively newsletters filled with cartoons and poems and vivid memories and all the latest news on members. So, even if no one else knew, even if their families didn't know, they did. And they knew and know that they have good reason to be very proud. While the story of Bletchley Park is one of extraordinary ingenuity in the face of implacable and seeming mathematical impossibilities, the story of the Y Service is about this, but also about furious dedication, great technical skill, brilliant accuracy, and, above all, superhuman patience and endurance. As one veteran has remarked, their work could only start when the enemy himself had started work. And then they were required to perform at dazzling speeds with minds concentrated like laser beams. As some other veterans have pointed out, this was not a job for older people. Even those in their mid-30s were liable to burn out swiftly under the weight of the pressure. But for eager teenagers and young people in their 20s, the brain was still supple enough to cope. And after their arduous shifts, they were equally good at seeking out the fun and the laughter that would shake all that weight off. So this is not quite the story of the course of the war being changed by one single factor, not directly at least, but were it not for the amazing technical efforts, the special liaison units, all the stations, all those encoded messages relayed with such care, then the codebreakers of Bletchley Park would have had very little to go on. All the boffins, all the brave young wrens sailing out into dangerous oceans, plus the intrepid radio-carrying agents out in the field, hurrying from border to border in an effort to stay ahead of the enemy. This is to say nothing of all those thousands of preternaturally focused young women, some permanently damaging their hearing for the sake of doing their duty. Their efforts combined helped to make all the revolutionary leaps of Bletchley Park possible. Thank you. Yes. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, and next week we'll be returning to more talks from this year's Turing Education Day. Many thanks to everyone involved in the podcast, especially Audioboo, without whom it wouldn't be possible.